Hello.
Hello, this is episode 3 of our podcast, Tales for the Tea Room. And we've moved location today, haven't we, Edgar?
We are right at the top of the Royal Mile. Well, not right in the middle, mm-hmm. on the Royal Mile. For those who are not familiar with Edinburgh, the Royal Mile connects Edinburgh Castle with Holyrood Palace at the bottom. And, well, we are here at Jason's flat. And today's episode is special because this is our first episode with a guest. So we have a guest speaker today, Tyler Thompson.
Yes, hello, Edgar. How are you doing? Jason.
Hi, Tyler. Tyler's a colleague of ours from Edinburgh University. And we thought it'd be really interesting to hear about Tyler's research.
He just finished his master's dissertation in counselling and psychotherapy with the theme Psychotherapists' Use of Grindr.
Yeah, so I haven't finished just yet. The dissertation's still out for marking, but I'm expecting a good grade, a good result. But yeah, no, I enjoyed researching my topic of how gay male therapists are experiencing Grindr.
Can you tell us what drew you to that topic to begin with? Is this something that's going on for you at the moment?
Well, so yes, the short answer to that, Jason, is yes. It was personally meaningful for me for a variety of reasons, but I think most notably was when I was on my training course, I felt tension within myself when I would be using Grindr to be non-monogamous and have sexual relationships through Grindr, or hookups, you know, in quotations, right? Which was a normal part of my culture back home in Texas, and that oftentimes was celebrated amongst my gay friends, and, oh, mm-hmm. you know, did you use protection? That's great, mm-hmm. you know, good for you, you got laid. But then it seems like as a professional trainee, that's where tension arose, like, oh, this feels transgressive. I shouldn't be doing this. Should I? I don't know. Mm. There's anxiety.
So you felt it was different energy or different... You were positioned different here in Edinburgh to what you were back home. Did you feel some sort of moral, ethical tension that hadn't been around previously?
Right. So you're talking about the morality of the use of Grindr. Well, I guess I did. I mean, but yes and no. So like in Texas, it felt like I say we were in a community of gay men, and it was like I say celebrated. Whereas here, it felt transgressive, and I'm not sure if it was morality or rather, I do know that it was rooted in perhaps fear of being rejected from professional bodies. Right. So. Not my own morality, but perhaps the morality of other people.
Because I'm trying to think about when I did my training, there was very much an emphasis on very clear, thick boundaries between the client and myself. I was trained in the psychodynamic tradition, which is called that, you know, blank screen, allow all the transference and the projection to happen from the client back to the counsellor. And that was very much present for me in my training rooms when I was having discussions around that. And so to be on a hookup site like Grindr felt, was that something I was comfortable bringing to that situation? And equally, how would it have gone down with my colleagues who were not necessarily using hookup apps?
Who would have been hip to the idea of a hookup app?
I think there is something quite different between these two cultures that we are talking about, because in the gay culture it's something quite normalized, it's something that
it's arguably perfectly ubiquitous.
Yes, and it's if you don't use these apps, how would you get to know other gay men? And it's different from the culture in the profession of counseling and psychotherapy, because it's supposed to remain something quite discreet. You are not supposed to to reveal much about, at least historically.
Yes.
I mean, this is changing with other psychotherapeutic approaches, but traditionally, the client wasn't supposed to know much about the therapist, so there is something quite different.
Yes.
There.
Yeah, and I think you make a good point, which I spent time in my literature review looking at, was the historical context in which therapy has emerged. And it's a profession that's kind of originated, right, as a service where heterosexual men were practicing therapy on, quotes, vulnerable, hysterical women, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there were no women in doing psychotherapy.
Mm.
And yeah, that's quite important to say, because it has evolved quite quickly. I think culture has advanced, has progressed or moved faster than the codes for practice.
Yeah.
And I read the part of your literature review, and there was something about there are no guidelines for counselors and
no.
psychotherapists in the use of dating apps or hookup apps.
No, and that caused a lot of anxiety for some of my participants, right, and myself included. But what I found interesting was that some participants were arguing that there needn't be any guidelines, and they preferred not to have guidelines, because I think their argument, or one argument, was that it was unnecessary, and because we're not regulating heterosexuals' use of apps, we don't need to be doing gay people's use of apps either.
So would they open? Should we go back a step and sort of explain how you then approached the research? Because, well, I think we're sort of talking ahead of slide there. So you went out and did interviews then with.
I did.
Do you want to say who you interviewed in terms of numbers and who those people were? And
specific names? No,
no.
I'm just teasing. Yeah, so I did. I interviewed 5 therapists across the United Kingdom, varying ages and experience levels, some with many years of experience and some with just a few months.
And did they come from different approaches to counselling?
Yes, everyone kind of had a different take or perspective on how they viewed counselling, but most people were either humanist, psychodynamic, nothing too bizarre.
And I guess just to reiterate, these were all men that you interviewed?
Yes.
And they were all active users on Grindr?
They had been active users at Grindr at one point in time.
So I think that sort of sets the scene in terms of discussing what you found and such like. And I was just interested in the point you just made then, Tyler, in terms of they were saying we shouldn't necessarily be moderating or dictating gay men's lives. Were they open to any ethical boundaries that covered heterosexual relationships or trans relationships as well? Because, you know, I have female friends who use Tinder, for example, equally for a sexual hookup.
Yeah.
Did you discuss that in your research in terms of, so be moderating hookup apps per se rather than a particular population's use of hookup apps?
Well, I'm not sure I understand.
Because what you're saying there is any guidance could potentially be seen as discriminatory because it was covering gay men's lives rather than heterosexual lives.
Pathologizing gay men or something.
So another way of looking at that would be that there would be generic guidance that would cover everybody.
Right, yeah.
Because I'm saying I have female therapy friend who uses Tinder.
No, and so I think this was one voice among the 5 that was kind of saying this, and his reasoning was that it was unnecessary. And full stop. I don't think he said, you know, we don't need to do it for women or heterosexual.
And are you able to say anything about how your participants negotiated Grindr and therapeutic work?
Yeah, and so that was kind of the bread and butter of my research. Really, it's important to say that my research project wasn't like this in-depth analysis of, rather it was a kind of like a broad brushed look at what themes are happening for gay male therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And I, after doing all of the research, I kind of aggregated all of the themes and found that I had like 22 viable themes to research. And it was a bit overwhelming. Everything from the digital age and age itself to body shame and figure and diversity and race and ethnicity and just everything. There's so many viable ways to research that through the lens of Grindr.
Was it difficult for the therapists and for you to talk about this very, very gay thing to do, that is just
using Grindr?
Yeah,
on Grindr or not have sex? Yeah, so it was hard, but I remember I had a colleague interview me before I conducted my interviews. So I would know what it felt like, and it was a bit awkward, but that helped inform how I went about conducting my interviews, because the nature of the topic was a bit like provocative sometimes,
mm-hmm.
or shame-inducing potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So what came up for you when you were interviewed yourself, which is a really interesting sort of concept in itself, to be your own participant in your own study, but talking about tricky topics, how was that for you?
Let's see. How's that? It was terribly revealing, because as a pseudo participant,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to provide as much information for the study as I could, and I imagine a lot of my participants felt similarly.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it really was. I felt quite naked sometimes during that process, and I imagine participants did as well.
Mm. Yeah, because it's something quite intimate,
mm.
I would say, something quite...
Well, I'll tell you something. So, the interviews, with all of my participants, I started off gently with, oh, what's your theoretical orientation, you know, what's some just background information on you, da-da-da, and that was fine, right? And then participants would also, then I'd go, okay, so now we'll move on to Grindr, and they talk about Grindr, how they use it, and that was pretty fine too. And then when you mix their therapeutic life and their Grindr usage in life, that's when people started to get really uncomfortable in the interview.
Mm.
Do you have a sense why that was?
There's a variety of reasons. It just seemed taboo to mix these worlds together. But there's one example from one participant who was ashamed of his fetish. So he used Grindr to fulfill his sexual needs,
mm-hmm.
you know, safe, consensually, all sex positive,
mm-hmm.
sort of go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was worried that, and he didn't use a face photo, so he was worried that his peers would find out, and that's what was the shame that was driving his tension when those two subjects mixed.
So it wasn't so much clients finding out as much as colleagues.
Yes. It seemed... Well, to be honest, it seemed that like most participants were less worried about what clients would think or do because of, as you mentioned earlier, their use of boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's boundaries were they were pretty well thought out, although they were all different, but they were pretty structured. They were very
mm-hmm.
structured and very solid. Very few people had lackadaisical boundaries, which...
So they had a considered position.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everyone was well thought out. Some were odd, but some were different.
But it was that judgment from peers that they really feared somehow.
Yes, not from the clients. They really feared reprisal from governing bodies, or as you said earlier, the coworker who doesn't understand or whatever. Yeah.
Because I know certainly when I did my training, we came from a very diverse background, but I certainly came across people with quite strong Christian views.
Yes.
And I don't think I personally would have been comfortable then discussing my own Grindr use in that space.
In an arena with potentially volatile viewpoints.
Yeah, because it felt very shaming, very judged. Again, that's my own imagination, my own projections possibly onto them. So yeah, I can feel that tension myself in terms of how would I be judged by my peers.
Yeah, and that was palpable for a couple of the participants.
And what that says about a profession that prides itself on difference and diversity, but yet may have some tension asking problems amongst its own population, amongst its own peoples.
Yeah.
And difference and diversity of being positively, being okay with the labels, but not with the practice. the modern day gay men.
What are we exactly? Spot on.
That we are not just, you know, fulfilling the stereotypes of being funny, witty, great shoppers, but actually when we're home alone or whatever, we are using hookup apps or, you know, certain number
and,
of us are.
And it goes, and yeah, it, and it goes beyond just gay male therapists. I think all human beings, to a greater or lesser extent, are sexual creatures. And I think this type of questioning, this research, and the fact that a therapist is a sexual, to as I say, to a greater or lesser extent, entity, like might need to be addressed by governing bodies in some capacity, is my own opinion.
I wonder if there's a conversation before that in terms of how, I'm trying to phrase it right now, in the sense of how accepting are we of, or how accepting are other populations of gay men's use of apps such as Grindr? Because I don't just necessarily see it as an uncomfortable conversation within the counselling profession, but within
the social context.
Within the social context, in a workplace or in other settings, in other professional settings. Or, you know, with family or friends or whatever. I don't know about you, Edgar, how you feel about that, but maybe that's a conversation, an initial conversation in terms of how open are we as gay men discussing our use of these apps? And then maybe a secondary conversation is taken into a professional context.
Well, I think that's exactly what this research is going to provoke, because you are doing this, you are starting this conversation on a professional level within the counselling community. Well, these five participants and you, and then now us, and I think listeners now, and this conversation is starting, and I think it's really great to have that type of research that is quite courageous, because accepting that we have used, or we use, or we felt curious about using some of these apps, and that we are sexual beings, and that sometimes the social scenario doesn't allow us to get to know other gay men as easily as we would like to, and then we use the tools that are available to us, and so this conversation is great, and then hopefully there will be some governing bodies or some institutions, organizations that listen to this, because I think it's really, really important to have some guidelines I would really like to that when I was doing my master's 10 years ago, I would have liked, not 12 years ago, my gosh, I would have loved to read in the ethics code some orientation in regards to this, because I wasn't using Grindr because I think that didn't even exist.
2007.
But I was on another very nice website. It wasn't even an app; it was a website, and I used to love it. But I was feeling like, okay, so this is a little bit blurring the professional etiquette or something.
Etiquette is a nice word.
And what would the guidance have looked like for you? What would you have liked to have seen, or not for you personally?
I would have liked to see, and I would like to see now, some inviting reflexivity for counselors to see that when you are there, it's potentially visible for your clients, for people, and that you just need to be cautious about what you are uploading, and that you are happy that with what you are uploading there is something that is not harmful for you or for your profession or for your clients or for your other people around you.
And I think who, what, where, when, and why, and what intervention, you know, the mechanics or the implementation of these ideas is up for debate, right? Because I think it's emerging, and the governing bodies haven't put anything out, and I think we're at a point now as professionals we can maybe decide and debate and have a discourse about what we want.
Yeah,
these
because
boundaries to be.
Yeah, because I mean these governing bodies are formed by us therapists.
Yeah.
We have votes and we have a saying in what these organizations in Scotland, COSCA, and the UK VACP, we have a saying in what it's that we can do in this regard. So I think it is something quite worth talking about.
What's that?
So I've got a book out. This is Dominic Davies, who you know, I think,
yeah.
don't you,
yeah.
Tyler? And he talks, and this comes from
Pink Therapy.
And
yeah.
This is the second of his books, Therapeutic Perspectives. And my mind went to when you were talking there about how therapists should work with themselves, in terms of, because I think one of your themes is around shame.
Yes, very much so.
And such like. And Dominic talks about these lovely in his work. And, you know, I was going to look at the psychoanalytic one, because that reminds me of your, how psychoanalytic therapists should address homophobia at every level, and that includes within themselves.
Yeah.
Internalised homophobia. And he says here, I'm just looking at page 119, it is essential that therapists have sufficiently worked through their own shame so that they can contain and work sensitively with that of others.
Mm-hmm.
And that really feels important. And then therapists have a robust awareness of the extent and impact of homophobia.
In our society.
In our society.
Yeah.
And that feels, what comes up for me in your work is, it feels like gay male therapists are doing a lot of that work themselves. But we're feeling shame either projected onto us rightly or wrongly from colleagues potentially around. And that could be an imaginative.
Fantasy or not fantasy.
A fantasy or not fantasy. So my invitation is for therapists of all sexualities, all genders, to think about how do they feel when a colleague says they're using a hookup app.
Heroin, a hookup
yeah.
app is using.
You know, but something like Grindr, if he's a female, you know, even a male using Tinder or whatever. What comes up for them? You know, what moral judgments are they making? What, and so, because I think that's important. Then it's the same if a client reports that they're using those apps back. So I certainly experienced a level of not understanding. So I certainly didn't feel the core conditions being offered to me when I spoke about my own grinding use.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm just going to pull out a pen and paper so I can jot down my thoughts. Edgar, did you want to pick up on that, or?
I stopped thinking when you mentioned homophobia and internalized homophobia, and it's because I don't think that this has to do necessarily with homophobia or internalized homophobia or with moral principles. I think it has to do, at least for me, with certain quality of service as a professional, that if and I detect something similar from what you were saying, Tyler, that it's not a moral issue for you, that it's for me the issue would be what would be the impression or the impact that would cause on clients if they see my profile there and they see what are my sexual interests and they see pictures of say in various levels of undress and they see what is the impact of that regardless of the morality behind it, because I don't think that it's a moral issue, but it's will that affect my practice, will that affect the fact that that potential client might be, or how is that going to affect the relationship? So I think it is more a professional.
For me, I guess where I was coming from was how comfortable, and I've been in situations where I've not felt comfortable to bring any issue I would have around that back to my peer groups of different types, because I feel I would have been judged in those peer groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have had to have done quite a lot of explaining.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I would have felt, or I would have experienced some moral judgment.
I think gay people historically have existed on the margins of society, right? And now we're kind of being integrated into the fold in all sorts of ways. And now cruising was a thing, and that was a part of gay culture for a long time, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Is still a punk.
Cruising in real life and online.
And online, yes, yeah. The digital age has changed it. Yes, it is. But I was thinking back of like the hanky codes, right, where you would have like a yellow handkerchief for best player.
What does this mean?
do you want me to guess?
Explain to listeners, Edgar's just holding up a very flamboyant polka dot handkerchief that he's very proudly wearing.
It's not polka dot.
I've got my glasses on at the moment, that's why, was it?
It's a
highly patterned.
Bellissimo. Very beautiful. But yeah, so things have changed, but what was I saying? My point. We've existed on the margins, we're being brought into the fold, and I think what we're experiencing now is the turbulence of being brought into hegemonics as culture and society.
Mm.
I think you both have two really good points. One, I make the argument that there's a culture that is homophobic and internalizes homophobia
mm-hmm.
within us, and that
mm-hmm.
affects us as therapists. I think that happens. But also, what you say, a couple echoes with what some of the other participants were saying, was that, you know, really, I'm worried about how this will affect my client. Some didn't,
mm-hmm.
some weren't as concerned with that,
mm-hmm.
but actually some are very concerned
mm-hmm.
with it. And that's how they use that to manage their boundaries. So if I can make one example, in terms of professionalism, the splitting would happen, right? And so they would split, was one client would split his personal life and his professional life. So personal life being the Grindr usage, and then his professional life being his therapeutic life. And he wouldn't use pictures or identifying characteristics on his the Grindr profile. He would just put his sexual fetish. And he would wait and have people respond to him first in this laissez-faire pursuit of sexual needs, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And that way he could identify, wait, okay, so this isn't one of my clients, then I can move forward and show my pictures and then get this interaction.
So a very cautious approach to interacting with other users.
Yes.
And that's one approach, isn't it? For him in particular, I guess, because he hasn't got a face profile on, you know, a face photograph on his profile.
Disclosed very little, yeah.
He may be missing out on certain opportunities.
Yes. Well, there's another interesting case where another client took it to an extreme in the opposite direction, where he was signposting, so he put his face profile on there and his sexual desires,
mm-hmm.
But he also put where he worked
mm-hmm.
at a therapeutic clinic, which I found really fascinating. And also curious, because he was signposting community members
mm-hmm.
to mental health help.
Mm-hmm.
And in his conceptualization, he was helping the community while also meeting his needs at the same time.
And that's the very opposite polar approach to what you just spoke about with your other participants.
One was quite boundaried and one was not as...
But what you spoke about earlier on, that common theme was as long as... of being considerate of the client's needs and wants and doing no harm, which is the core of...
What is it? Benevolence or non-maleficence.
But that being the core of the ethical approach, but how they negotiated that differed wildly.
Yes.
And that feels, a lot of that feels their own positioning, their own sense of where they located themselves in that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, two themes there is just A, working therapeutically with the client, and as Edgar says, you know, being considerate of the therapeutic consequence of using these apps. And for me, how am I accepted within my own peer communities when I want to bring my use of those apps into those discussions?
You mentioned that earlier, and I don't think we picked that up.
Yeah, it was just, you know, because as I say, I've had a couple of situations where I've not felt comfortable to bring that back to different professional groups that I've been in, because I felt I would have been judged away. So for me, that's another side of that conversation. So
the silence.
The silence or the judgment on that. Because
mm-hmm.
we're a broad church, us therapists. As practitioners, you know, we're a broad church. And so I'm interested in the professional bodies, because we talk about the professional bodies need to have, you know, conversations around possibly creating some guidance around that. How do they position themselves? Who's making those judgments on whatever? So the professional peer conversation and the professional around the therapeutic.
I hear.
And those two conversations for me that needs to go around. And no right and wrong conversations, but how do we locate ourselves? And I guess my invitation to for the practitioners, if somebody in a peer group brings that information back to the group, how are you as an individual hearing that, you know, somebody's use of Grindr? And because some of what you talked about is quite, could be seen as quite ethically challenging. Somebody who has their own photo and signposting to services.
Yes, and might be having pictures of them being fisted or something on their, or wanting to be fisted on their profile, and then also signposting.
Yeah. And bringing that back into a group in a different context, how's that going to
affect clients and peers?
Yeah.
And it's a mess, and people are struggling, I think, to navigate it a bit.
So if you could summarise your research for us, what's the takeaway messages that you want Egwin and I and our listeners to what you've written about?
I brought my conclusion in, so let me have a quick look at that. I brought these for you guys.
Oh, thank you.
They're hard to get a hold of.
So Tyler's given us some folders from the university that we went to with some lovely logos on. Thank you.
Yes. Right.
They're lovely.
Yeah, thanks. After my research, and what I would like listeners and people to start doing is having conversations about their sexuality and their professional life, and the intersection of these things, is what was my passion for doing this.
Mm.
I think there's a silence in that area, and I think silence is hazardous in so many different ways.
So a sense of this, you're inviting a conversation.
I'd like people to have more conversations about this topic.
So I think, you know, how Egg and I can help is by putting your details on our podcast and people can get in touch with you.
My Grindr details or my research detail? I'm just teasing. Or not, maybe. Let me check my conclusion. I may have a couple things I wanted to say. Right, so what came up in my research, some themes that were branched off of these that need more research. So if there's researchers out there, here's a couple of things that you can look at. There was this theme surrounding age and gayness, about not wanting to be this cliche, predatory older man, and that was present for a lot of my participants. And I think that's an area that needs more attention, because it manifested in a variety of different ways for participants. I think another interesting area for research would be how gay researchers interview gay interviewees. There's one interview where power dynamics was present, and it was a very challenging interview. And I think more research might be useful there in understanding research methods and power, or something about that. Also, there still needs to be more research about how technology is affecting gay male therapists, full stop. Specifically, how gay male therapists are representing themselves in the digital age, what they choose to disclose, and why they're choosing to disclose a big theme. And I think that would help us understand therapist behavior. And, wait, hold on, I'm getting lost in my thoughts. Right, so I'd like to ask therapists, what degree does our behavior on Grindr translate to our therapeutic practice? And so if we're chaotic or structured on Grindr, are we chaotic or structured in the room, and the relationship between the two? That needs depth, more depth of research. Yes, and those are my final thoughts.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I think it's, as I said earlier, and even more now, I think it's a very important theme to research on, and a very courageous thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for sharing it with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was lovely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you to our listeners for this listening to this third episode of Tales from the Tea Room. And thank you, Tyler.
Cheers.
Bye.